You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Donald Trump embarks on a surprise visit to Mexico City, which should at least be good news for local pitchfork suppliers and tomato vendors. My guests John Everard and Samira Shackle will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the US suggesting that Pakistan might find itself disbarred from the captain's table unless it makes more effort against domestic terrorists, the UK Labour Party apparently poised to reaffirm Jeremy Corbyn as leader, a move which seems to many akin to the 7th Cavalry re-electing George Custer the night before marching on the Little Bighorn, and Ukraine imposing new visa strictures on visitors from North Korea, a move which prompts many questions, not the least of which is, were there any? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Samira Shackle, freelance journalist contributing to The New Statesman, Guardian, Al Jazeera, Deutsche Welle, Monocle, indeed, and others. Welcome both. We will start tonight with an exercise in diplomatic outreach startling even by the standards already set by the presidential campaign of Orange former game show host Donald Trump. He's going to Mexico, presumably to tell them to their faces that they're drug dealers, criminals and rapists, and or get in ahead of the wall he's going to build, even if he becomes president in November, which he won't. A reminder, first of all, of some of Trump's previous extensions of his tiny, stumpy hands across the Rio Grande.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. Listen to this. Trump, who has dismissed some Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, or simply put, as Hitler. Do you believe? Now, the Hitler one I've never heard until this morning when I woke up. By the way, I love Mexican people. I have such a great relationship to Mexico. I hire thousands of people, the rich Mexicans, they're great people. Friends of mine, they buy my apartments. And by the way, I think I'm going to win the Mexican vote.
John, Donald Trump is going to Mexico City. What could possibly go wrong?
For him, really? For him, very little. Remember, he's been invited to go there. Peña Nieto invited both him and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton still thinking about where she goes. What could possibly go wrong? Look, he has already said that he is going to start the conversation about the wall. He's not going to start making nice with Mexico. This is going to be delivering very hard messages to the Mexicans. His fan base will rejoice. This is a man actually talking turkey to the Mexicans just for once. If the Mexicans say, this is terrible, you can't do that, his fan base again rejoice and his vote rises. If his dream, there are demonstrations and riots outside wherever it is they hold the talks, he wins again. I mean, for Donald Trump, this is actually a very clever move. Doing it right before a major speech on immigration, where his aides are saying he is going to double down on all the things he's been saying, the wall, throwing out the illegals, no mercy. That is, again, going to resonate with the kind of people who are going to vote for him.
Samira, as John points out, Donald Trump is going to Mexico City at the invitation of the president. If, as John says, it's basically a no-lose situation for Trump, what is in it for Mexico's President Nieto? Why invite Donald Trump? I mean, I'm struggling to think of parallels at this point. It defies simile.
Yeah, it's very odd, isn't it? I mean, he is sort of mired in I think record low approval ratings for any Mexican.
So he's thinking,
president,
I'm going to invite the only person, yeah, that the Mexican people dislike even more than me.
Exactly. I don't know if it, I mean, the only possible explanation I can think of is that it's a sort of distraction technique. He's got all sorts of scandals going on about human rights abuses, also about, I think there's a claim he'd plagiarised large sections of his thesis. So maybe he just
plenty
wants
to talk about there then.
Maybe he just exactly. Maybe he just wants to sort of a distraction. But as John pointed out, while it sort of seems rather no lose for Trump. There's a lot of scenarios where it could be a big loss for Nieto. I mean, unless he is seen by voters to really be sticking it to Trump and sort of getting one over on him somehow, which he, you know, it's not inconceivable that he won't do that. It could easily be quite damaging for him.
I think that's exactly what Peña Nieto is going to do. Peña Nieto, I mean, we focus on Trump. Peña Nieto himself is, shall we say, a bit of a character. And he has not got a great deal to lose. Barring a minor miracle, he is out of office very soon in any case. Why not go out with a bang? Why not go out saying things that Mexicans are going to remember? We can be reasonably confident that he is going to, in your phrase, stick it to Trump. He's going to give Trump just as much as he takes, and he's going to make sure that this goes all over the Mexican media. Trump's base will love it, as I just said. Peña Nieto's base are also going to like it a great deal as well. This should be good knockabout fun all round.
It'd be brilliant, wouldn't it, if he just challenged him to a duel? Just went absolutely old school.
Yes, wouldn't it? But then was the days, Andrew.
No, I know, yeah. I know. Samira, is there, and we are wandering possibly at this point into the realms of fantasy, is there somewhere in the United States, do you think, the Hispanic voter who up until this point has been fairly anti-Donald Trump for fairly obvious reasons, some of which we broadcast at the top of this show, who will turn on the news, see Donald Trump waving to the people of Mexico and thinking, oh, maybe he's not so bad, damn it, I'm on board?
I doubt it somewhat, but I think that there is obviously some concern in the Trump camp about his lack of appeal among that body of voters, because he's been softening his rhetoric in general about, particularly about this issue of the, I think it's, what's the number, is it 11 million or something?
11 million, give or take. Nobody's entirely sure, yeah, this being always obviously course, an issue, yeah, with
but
illegal
immigration. You know, illegal migrants to the US, he's been softening his rhetoric. Having previously spoken about deportation squads, he's now sort of evading the question and being quite vague about what he'd do about that. So I think there's some awareness that it's not great that the Hispanic vote is not on board with Trump, let's say. So I don't know if him making a trip to Mexico, given that we're all working on the assumption that it's not going to be a particularly friendly and sort of friendship building trip, is going to play particularly well with those voters. Perhaps he's hoping, in somehow softening his rhetoric on those other things, he will reach out.
I very much doubt he'll soften his rhetoric. I think he already
has, though. There's clips of him speaking on news broadcasts, evading the question very much, where he'd previously been quite unequivocal about deportation squads.
Well, yes, I mean, he's building up to a big speech. He's not going to take any of the thunder, is he? I think firstly, it's important to recognise that not all Latino voters in the United States are in favour of immigration from Mexico.
Indeed not.
It's a very complicated, very, very, very nuanced kind of question. Secondly, I think that Donald Trump has probably decided that he is not going to shift the Latino vote. So why not double down on your existing supporters, build a movement, and, you know, at least get the benefit there. Also, as a final thought here, we focus on the presidential election 2016. I frankly doubt if that is what this is all about. I think Trump knows he is going to lose this election, and what he's doing is building a movement for 2020, 2024. He's a patient man, he's got a lot of backers and a lot of momentum. Trump is going to go on, Trumpism is probably going to get stronger.
Well, that's a happy thought, and thank you for that, John. Samira, is there, do you think, the possibility that, well, let's look at it from the other point of view. Let's assume that Donald Trump is one of that minority of people who still thinks he can win in November. And is he therefore perhaps being confronted with the reality of what he has promised? The one promise that everybody associates with him is that he will build this wall across the Rio Grande and get Mexico to pay for it. Now, unless he has completely taken leave of his senses, he knows he can't actually do that. He knows he can't deport 11 million people either. Mm. I mean, he does. Is there a chance that he is actually trying to behave like a sensible politician, trying to modify his statements in order to try and attract centrist independent voters?
Possibly. I think there's a bit of panic in the Trump campaign, and that was evident when his spokeswoman was asked about the trip to Mexico, what he was planning to say, and she just said he'd be very presidential, which I thought was quite telling. So I think that there is an awareness that the numbers aren't good, and they're not good for... They're not looking good for him. As you say, it's a small minority of people who think he can win in November. I don't know about how successful he'll be in appearing sensible, because I think his appeal thus far hasn't really been about appearing sensible and in sort of attempting to do that. And if he does attempt to sort of soften certain aspects, he'll alienate his core vote. So I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work out. But it's not been particularly coherent, the sounds coming out of the Trump campaign so far.
I was going to say, there are squeaks of pain coming out of the Trump campaign. That's quite clear. But his aides have already made clear that he's not going to soften his rhetoric. He's going to go in thumping.
Okay, well, let's move along now to Pakistan and its relationship with the United States, one which is routinely described by professional understaters at the very pinnacle of their game as tricky. Pakistan, indeed, was once reportedly President Barack Obama's answer to the question of what keeps him awake at nights, and now Obama's senior-most diplomat, Secretary of State John Kerry, has urged Pakistan to ease the president's rest by doing more to thwart terrorism. Samira, Secretary Kerry made these remarks in New Delhi, which is a choice of backdrop not likely to endear him further to Pakistan. As far as it's possible to tell, what does the United States think Pakistan should be doing that Pakistan isn't?
I think what his comments were about was the supporting of terrorism overseas, so particularly in Afghanistan. And I think that's why there is a bit of a move towards New Delhi. There's massive frustration, understandably, in Washington about the fact that Pakistan, while cracking down on terrorism within its own borders, which it has actually been doing in a much more serious way in the last couple of years than I think for a really, really long time, certainly for decades, while that's happening concurrently, it does continue to operate this sort of shadow policy of supporting terrorist elements in Afghanistan. It doesn't want Afghanistan to become an Indian client state. I think whether announcing a sort of talks between Afghanistan, India and the US, which John Kerry also did today, which will exclude Pakistan, will ease that anxiety. I very much doubt it will. It'll probably cause Pakistan to double down. But I can also see, I mean, you can see in John Kerry's position, you'd sort of wonder what you can do. They've already suspended a big payment of military aid to Pakistan, to the Pakistani military, on the basis, I think, that they're very frustrated about the continued tacit support for Afghan terrorists. But I think within Pakistan, I spent a substantial amount of time there just earlier this year. I think that what will be taken from this will be frustration at the fact that there is this big military operation that's been going on, and not just a military operation in the northern areas, also sort of matched by police operations in the cities. It's really big, wide-scale, sweeping anti-terror operation. And so I don't think it's going to play particularly well in Pakistan for John Kerry to say Pakistan should join the war on terror. So I think it was probably quite poorly phrased, but...
John, as Samira correctly points out, these trilateral talks are happening next month between the US, India and Afghanistan. Is there a message for Pakistan there in the fact that they have been rather pointedly not invited?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What we're watching is a strategic shift in US foreign policy, which for a long time has been studiously even-handed between Pakistan and India. And the fact that, as you pointed out, what he said about Pakistan terrorism was said in New Delhi, of all places, is itself an indicator of just how far Washington's position has shifted. It is now, especially since the ascent of Modi, putting its weight much more strongly behind India than Pakistan. I agree with everything that Samir has just said about Pakistan terrorism and the links with Afghanistan that are going on. But it's important to remember, too, that Kerry made this remark amidst a flurry of accusation and counter-accusation over Kashmir, with the Indians saying that the Kashmiri violence has been effectively Pakistani orchestrated, that Pakistan's been sending in people to stir it all up.
This is what India always says when this happens, though.
Yes, indeed. This itself is not new. What is new is that the only US response to these Indian accusations, statements, what you want to call them, is Kerry saying that Pakistan needs to do more about terrorism within its own borders. That is about as close as you can come to saying, I think India's right, without actually using those words.
Samira, when it comes to that question of doing more to combat terrorism and militancy within its own borders, how beholden is any Pakistani government, with the best will in the world, by what you might call public opinion? The thing I always keep thinking, I think it often gets forgotten how vast a country Pakistan is. And even if only 1% of Pakistan's population have sympathies towards militant fundamentalism, I'm pretty sure at least 1% of the population does. That's getting on for 2 million people.
Yeah, I think that's always been a question. And I think that's been something that's not just that percentage of the population, which does undoubtedly support religious fundamentalism and militancy in some cases, but also the power of the conservative religious lobby, which is really embedded at all different levels of society. And there's this real squeamishness and fear about offending that conservative religious lobby. And let's not forget that this is a country where blasphemy carries the death sentence. I think that tells you quite a lot. But that's why I think in the last couple of years, there really has been a much more serious effort against terrorism. And it's not flawless at all, and there's still far more terrorist attacks than there should be. But sort of having been there a couple of months ago compared with a year before and a year before that, there really has been a much more serious attempt, at least, to counter violent terrorism and terrorist networks, at least within the country. That doesn't really go for networks which are carrying out their violence outside the country, I think. And that, I think, is in large part to do with public opinion. It really kicked off after the attack in Peshawar in December 2014, when about 130 children were killed by Taliban gunmen. And that really did cause a widespread revulsion in the country in a way that I think other attacks, which might have even had higher death tolls or similar death tolls, hadn't. There was something about it which was quite shocking, I think, even in a place where violence is quite routine and where big-scale terrorist attacks are quite routine. So I think that's why there's been a more significant effort against terrorism. But it is undoubtedly true that, you know, that conservative lobby and that segment of conservative opinion in the population is a real limitation, because there, you know, you might carry out a police operation or a military operation against terrorist groups, but if you're not doing anything to tackle, say, the preachers who are spreading certain ideologies or whatever it is, and or say the political parties which are maybe not directly espousing violence but tacitly are, then I think you're sort of limited once that military and police operation ends, as it inevitably must.
And I guess there's that large overlapping part of the spectrum as well between conservative religious people and actually militant ones, in which I imagine quite a lot of people live.
Yes, absolutely. And there's lots of people who, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's that it's a complicated relationship, and undoubtedly there are many more conservative religious people than there are militants, but there is a sort of symbiotic relationship in a way. And I think particularly what's unusual in some ways is the way that that's so embedded into the mainstream. So you have sort of large organisations which claim to be philanthropic organisations and are not banned within Pakistan but are sort of prohibited by the UN or different international organisations as quite blatantly being supportive of terrorism, if not carrying it out. So it's embedded in the mainstream, and that's the really tricky bit, I think. So once the money for the military operation and the police operations dries up, what happens then? Does it go back to the situation it was in before? I think it probably does.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and John Everard. Coming up next, the unending dumpster fire that is the UK Labour Party.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a Monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and John Everard. Now, it is still incredibly nearly another month until the United Kingdom's opposition Labour Party finally calls an end to its already interminable leadership contest, and in doing so, on form, calling a beginning to its next leadership contest. But polls released today suggest that current leader Jeremy Corbyn, who other polls suggest stands roughly no chance of ever winning a general election, will be returned by party members. Samira, for what imaginable reason?
I think that...
Not that I wish to lead the witness or anything.
Yeah. I think that some of the poll results in more detail were quite telling, that Corbyn polled very highly on whether he was principled and honest, where his opponent Owen Smith didn't. I think there's obvious problems, like Owen Smith hasn't had a particularly good campaign. I think Tbilisi clearly, the same poll showed he was sort of trailing in categories like whether he was competent and a strong leader and so on. And so given that his pitch was that he'd be like Corbyn in terms of ideology but more electable and more competent, I think the fact that he hasn't convinced on competency or electability is a pretty big problem, to say the least. So I think it's partly a weak opponent, and I think partly that given the makeup of the Labour Party membership, those who will be voting in the leadership election, it was kind of a foregone conclusion, I think, that this would be the case.
John, those same polls that Samira cites do also suggest that Owen Smith, though the challenger obviously lacking in some areas, is backed by a hefty majority, 68-32, of members who joined before May 2015. Are we making a mistake in continuing to think of the Labour Party as we have thought of it these last few decades? Is it basically now a completely new party that just hasn't quite changed its name?
Well, it's not as simple as that. It seems to be becoming two parties that haven't quite changed their name. It's quite clear that a large number of people have joined the Labour Party recently who are sympathetic to Jeremy Corbyn, quite possibly precisely because they want to vote for Jeremy Corbyn in leadership elections. How this is going to play with the, shall we call them, the more traditional Labour base is far from clear. We already know, of course, how it plays with the parliamentary party. They don't like Corbyn, they don't think he can lead, and people are refusing en masse to take part in his shadow cabinet. I am so old that I remember 1981. The previous Labour split. Remember January 1981, the Wembley conference where the Labour Party voted against nuclear deterrence and wanted to leave what was then the European Economic Community, now the European Union, of course. Within 8 weeks, we had the Limehouse Declaration and four senior Labour politicians had walked from the party. Much more of what is going on at the moment, and I think there's a real possibility that exactly the same happens, that people within the Parliamentary Labour Party feel they simply cannot belong to a party which is led by Jeremy Corbyn, who enjoys this massive popular support, and that they decide to go their own way. It's going to get quite messy.
I mean, what is the potential future, and I'll put this to you, Samira, of the Labour Party if Corbyn continues to lead it, which it seems almost certain he will, despite the fact that no poll I've read and almost no sane observer I've spoken to thinks there's any prospect of him ever leading Labour to a Commons majority at a general election. Is there still a point to the Labour Party if it cannot win government, bearing in mind that its own constitution commits it to seeking government through Parliament?
Yeah, it's a really bleak outlook, isn't it? I mean, if he does win again, as it looks like he will, it seems the two options are either a split in the party, which both camps are vociferously denying that they want to do, although I have also heard from various people working in the lobby in Westminster that both camps are also seeking legal advice about who'd get to keep the name and the structures and the union membership and so on. So how that plays out remains to be seen. The other alternative, I think, is that they sort of lumber on in this fashion, and it's very difficult to see how certain bridges could be repaired with some MPs. I mean, all sorts of MPs, and I think it's very, very simplistic the way the debate has often sadly played out in terms of sort of if you oppose Corbyn, you're a Blairite, because there are a lot of MPs who on the soft left of the party who tried to work with him, who actually came out with quite heartfelt, quite open, quite exposing statements about competency and about the ability to work with the leadership team and how difficult that was. It's very difficult to see how even those MPs who were initially willing to be supportive of the project would then come back into any sort of leadership roles. So, I mean, the alternative is then Labour lumbers on with a very, very inexperienced shadow cabinet, a leadership which is reportedly terrible at making decisions and at the sort of basic business of management. And actually, even that poll that we opened up with talking about, even the people who are supporting Corbyn and think that he's got, very principled, very honest, a lot of the same electorate also disagree with the idea that he's competent. I think it was 35%.
Yeah, no, I find that a lot, just anecdotally talking to Corbyn supporters who basically say, I know he's hopeless, but I'm voting for him anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So given that, I mean, what's the other option? It's decimation at the next general election, and then maybe they start again. I mean, it's pretty bad either way, isn't it?
I mean, John, just a final brief thought on this one. What possible opposition can an opposition leader provide when they know and everybody else knows that they cannot command their own parliamentary party? And it's not like it's a narrow run thing. It's not like it's 52-48-4.
No, that's right. It's quite clearly a great majority of the parliamentary party against Corbyn. The answer to your question is not a great deal. And I think that the Tories are sitting behind closed doors, sort of giggling happily at what's going on. Effectively, they are able to govern right now with nothing like an effective opposition. Of the two options that Shamir just sketched out, a split as I discussed earlier, lumbering on, yes, that I think may well happen. Important to recognise that this gap between the parliamentary Labour Party and the Labour base only exists until the next general election. The people who have managed to support Jeremy Corbyn will almost certainly return him as Labour leader, will almost certainly be able to deselect the great majority of the MPs who currently oppose him. We'll have a quite different Labour Party coming out of that election, and I suspect, in parliamentary terms, a much, much smaller one.
OK, well, finally tonight, that meagre fraction of the people of North Korea even permitted to contemplate foreign travel may have to strike Ukraine off their lists. Kiev has revoked a wrinkle in its visa rules, which dated back to Soviet times, which permitted citizens of the Democratic People's Republic visa-free travel to Ukraine. John, how many citizens of North Korea are actually likely to be directly affected by this?
Very few. There's a wrinkle in the article there. It wasn't for everybody, this wonderful visa freedom. It was only for people who had diplomatic or official passports. So North Korean diplomats posted to Ukraine from here on will need Ukrainian diplomatic visas. It's not going to affect the great masses of the Korean people, I'm afraid. Interestingly, I mean, Ukraine has just abolished this for very good reasons. The two countries whose citizens can travel freely to North Korea and which can be visited freely by North Koreans without visas are Singapore and Malaysia.
That would be a splendid pub quiz question, if possibly somewhat arcane. I can confirm from very recent and extremely bitter experience that getting a visa for Ukraine is absolutely no picnic for Australian passport holders either. Samira, but beyond that, and beyond sort of what appears to be a fairly routine clearing up of a bureaucratic anomaly, is there a danger when, as a general principle, in isolating a country like North Korea still further? Is it likely to modify their behaviour or just make them even crankier? Should the world be welcoming North Korean tourists?
Yeah. I don't know. I think most of them would be allowed to be tourists, even if those visa restrictions were lifted. I think it's part of a wider picture, isn't it? I think there have been efforts by South Korea recently to sort of lobby former allies of North Korea, many of them allies from the Soviet era, to sort of press for change in North Korea. I don't see particularly any signs that that's been effective. I guess there's a chance that it could be if you believe in the sort of back channels of diplomacy, so perhaps. But, the Ukrainian thing, as you say, was a sort of clearing up of old bureaucracies. But I think there have been other examples of countries tightening up on visas anyway, because there was a UN investigation last year about tens of thousands of North Koreans being sent abroad to work and bring foreign currency into the country under sort of forced labour conditions. So I think where there have been easier visa arrangements, they've been sort of exploited by the regime for quite negative purposes and not really for the purposes of broadening the minds of citizens.
Finally, and very briefly, John, are we likely to see any retaliation from North Korea over this? Any threats to turn Kiev into a lake of fire or some such?
Tragically, no. I think we'll be spared the rhetoric. A lot of other countries have taken similar steps before and seen no retaliation. I doubt if Ukraine will.
There's nothing I've noticed in today's edition of Rodong Sinmun, though on a closing note, they have found time to refer to Park Jun-hai, the president of South Korea, rebuking her for her recent, as they put it, imprudent vituperation of confrontation fanatic. Samira Shackle and John Everard, thank you very much for joining us as ever. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barclay Bram. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. More on the day's main stories with The Daily at 2200. I'll also be your host for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.